Now, live from the front lines in the crosshairs of the Corporados, it's the Enviro Show on WXOJLP 103.3 FN, Valley Free Radio in Northampton.
That's great. It starts with an earthquake. Birds and snakes and airplanes. Lenny Bruce is not afraid. I have a hurricane. Listen to yourself. Turn world serve its own needs. Dummy serve your own needs. Beat it up and not speak. Grunt. No strength. None matter. Start to clatter with fear. Fight down. High wire and a fire. Represent the seven games. In the government for hire. And the combat sites. Net to us are coming in a hurry with the furies beating down your neck. My team reporters battle Trump, Kevin Kraft, look at that, no play, fine, death, uh-oh, overflow, population, common group, but it'll do, save yourself, serve yourself, world, serve your own needs, listen to your heartbeat, dummy, with the rancher, and the reverend, and the right, right, you patriotic, patriotic, slam, fight, right, my penis, pretty sight,
it's the end of the world as we know it, it's the end of the world as we know it. End of the world as we know it, and I feel fine.
6 o'clock, TV hour, don't get caught in foreign power, slice and burn, return, listen to yourself, churn. Locking in, uniform and book, burning blood, letting every motive escalate, automotive centering, light a candle, light a motive, step down, watch a heel, crush, crush, uphold, this means no fear, cavalier, renegade, steer clear, turn them in a fly. Solutions offer me alternatives and I decline.
It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. It's the end of the world as we know it. I feel fine.
Divide mountains, say that alive, Leonard Bernstein, Liam Mad, Brass, Nap, Lenny, Russian, Lester Bank, birthday party, cheesecake, jelly bean, boom, symbiotic, patriotic, slam, button, nap, right?
Right. It's the end.
If you know it, it's the Corporado Water Raid Enviro Show. I'm one of your co-hosts, Dio.
And I'm Jane Grossholtz.
And I'm Glenn Ayers.
Greetings, Earthling. Guess who's poking around the Montague Plains looking to privatize the public aquifer? None other than Nestle, the Good Food, Good Life Corporados. We say, not good. Not good at all. These guys are raiding public resources all over the rural U.S. We'll speak tonight with Tim Simmons, a restoration ecologist with Mass Wildlife. He'll tell us about the ecological aspects of the Montague Plains. And us tree-hugging dirt worshippers here in the studio will rag on the corporators attempting yet again to privatize the commons. Indeed. Also, we check in with the vile machinations of Darth Janie once more in our Empire Notes segment, and another call from David Kruzma on the road with the Ride for Climate. Check it out, www.rideforclimate.com/USA. But first... special Imperial War on Terror edition of The Revenge of the Critters. This one's special for George's War on Terror. Giant badgers terrorize Iraqi port city. Daily Telegraph, July 11th. The Iraqi port city of Basra, already prey to a nasty turf war between rival militia factions, has now been gripped by a scary rumor. A giant badger, rather giant badgers in the plural, are stalking the streets by night, eating humans.
Attack of the killer badgers.
Take that, human, you terrorist. The animals were allegedly released into the area by British forces. Local farmers have caught...
What? Where did they get them?
Oh, I don't know. Well, let's read on.
Hey, local farmers... They always have badgers, don't they?
Yeah, I think so.
Local farmers have caught and killed several of the beasts, but this has done nothing to dispel the rumor. Iraqi scientists have attempted to calm things down. However, the story has spread like wildfire in the streets of the city and the villages round about. The director of Basra's veterinary hospital has inspected the corpses of several badgers and tries to reassure Iraqis that the animals are not a new post-war arrival in the region. These animals appeared before the fall of the regime in 86. They're all known as, locally as Al Gerda.
That sounds a lot like Al Gore.
Al Gore. Talk that this animal was brought by the British forces is incorrect and unscientific. Not everybody is convinced. I believe this animal appeared following a raid to the region by the British forces, said Ali Moshen, a farmer in his 40s from Karmat Ali, near the airbase used by the multinational force. Real close to the airport, they probably released this animal into the area. British troops have been based in Basra since 2003. Since the 2003 U.S.-led invasion overthrew dictator Saddam Hussein, and the 5,500 that remain still face the threat of Shiite militias battling for the region's oil resources. They also have to battle the Iraqi rumor mill, as locals are quick to blame them for almost any calamity that befalls the area, including an apparent plague of vicious badgers with long claws and powerful jaws. British Army spokesman Major David Gell said the animals were thought to be a kind of honey badger. Millivora capensis, which can be fierce, but not usually dangerous to humans, unless provoked. They're native to the region, but rare in Iraq. They're nocturnal carnivores with a fearsome reputation, but they don't stalk humans and carry them back to the lair, he said. Both the scientists and the soldiers agree that the badger ought not to be a danger to humans, but so far they have failed to reassure the populace. Quote, I was sleeping at night when this strange animal hit me on my head. I have not seen such an animal before. My husband hurried to shoot it, but it was swift as a deer. Saud Hussein, 30-year-old housewife, said, It's the size of a dog, but his head is like a monkey. It runs so quickly. Cell phone video of the badger circulating Basra shows a stocky, skunk-like animal with long front claws. The honey badger, or ratel, is known as a brave predator capable of killing a cobra. It weighs up to 14 kilograms. Sattar Jabbar, a 50-year-old local farmer from Abu Sakar, north of Basra, believes the badger can tackle even large prey. And we're closing with this quote. I saw it 3 days ago, at night, attacking animals. It even ate a cow. It tore the cow up piece by piece. I tried to shoot it with my gun, but it ran away into the orchards. I missed it, he said.
And the bullets bounced right off.
With a dog that with a monkey head that runs with skunk-like feet against people? I don't think so. I don't think
pretty
so.
Scary. Yeah.
But I say, if you lived in Iraq, you might make up things like that. There would be a lot more, make you a little bit happier than knowing the Americans are bombing the hell out of your country.
With that, let's move right on to Darth Janey. Glenn. Where's the theme?
I thought that was Darth Janey.
The theme.
Where's that theme?
There it is. There it is again, Glenn. The Darth Janey theme.
The Energia Chondroids releases from his bond.
science? Tell us quickly.
Well, according to the official backwards Bush countdown timer, we've been counting down now for quite a while. I can remember when this sucker was up like 1,100, something like that.
Back in the day.
Yeah. So right now, we have 545 days, 6 hours, 30 minutes, and 45 seconds. And that's it. That's all. That's it.
That's enough for them to do quite a lot of it.
Yeah, I think so.
Wow.
And, you know, it's looking, impeachment is looking better and better all the time. So
I don't think I'd like to get him impeached. I think maybe we should cover him in honey and stake him down on one of those great big ant hills.
Or one of those badgers.
Yeah, and then
the
every
badger.
Time an ant hit them, there would be one person that they've killed or somebody that died because they don't have any health insurance or...
We could run that done. Revenge of the Critters. For,
yeah, that'd be
for
Revenge of the Critters.
Yeah,
we'd love
endlessly.
It. We'd love it. Yeah,
because there's more ants out there than anything. We reported on Lord Cheney's secretive energy task force long ago, but now the Washington Post has revealed the names of the operatives from Big Oil and others who met with Darth to plan the takeover of Iraq, Washington, whatever. Yesterday,
all of the above.
Yes. Yesterday, by the way, was impeached Cheney Day. Did you know that? It was down
it was,
in Washington.
Yeah. And, oh, yeah, that's right. Cindy,
actually
Code Pink.
Cindy Sheehan got arrested in...
what's his name? Conyers'
John
office.
Conyers' office, yeah.
Do the impeachment thing right away. Also, last weekend, impeached Cheney was the number one video on YouTube. All right. So here's a report. Papers detail industry's role in Cheney's energy report. Yeah. It's from the Washington Post. They keep going after Cheney like one of those dogs that grabs onto your ankles.
Yeah?
Nasty little lap doggy thing.
Like a mosquito buzzing around his head.
We'll take some excerpts out. A confidential list prepared by the Bush administration shows that Cheney and his aides had already held at least 40 meetings with interest groups, most of them from the energy producing industries. By the time the meeting with environmental groups, according to a former White House official who provided the list to the Washington Post, the initial draft of the task force was substantially complete, and President Bush had been briefed on its progress. In all, about 300 groups and individuals met with staff members of the Energy Task Force, including a handful who saw Cheney himself in the flesh. According to the list, which was compiled in the summer of 2001, for 6 years, those names had been closely guarded. Thanks to the fierce legal battle waged by the White House, some names have leaked out over the years, but most have remained hidden because of a 2004 Supreme Court ruling that agreed that the administration's internal deliberations ought to be shielded from outside scrutiny. But now there's leaking going on. One of the first visitors on February 14th was James J. Rouse, then vice president of ExxonMobil. ExxonMobil. And a major donor to the Bush inauguration. A week later, longtime Bush reporter Kenneth Lay, then of the Enron Corp., came by.
Kenny Boy.
Yes.
Kenny Boy.
Came by for the first two meetings. On March 5, some of the country's biggest electric utilities, including Duke Energy and Constellation Energy Group, had an audience with the task force staff. British Petroleum representatives dropped by on March 22nd, one of about 20 oil and drilling companies to get meetings. The National Mining Association, the Interstate Natural Gas Association of America, and the American Petroleum Institute were among 36 trade associations that met with Cheney's staff, the document shows. The list of participants' names, when they met with the administration officials, provides a clearer picture of the task force priorities and bolsters the previous reports that the review leaned heavily on oil and gas companies and on trade groups, many of them big contributors to the Bush campaign and the Republican Party. But while it clears up much of the lingering uncertainty about who was granted access to present energy policy views to Cheney's staff, it does not entirely explain why the Bush administration fought so hard to keep it and other as yet unreleased internal memos secret.
That's because Mr. Cheney is secret.
Very
he really is hiding behind a huge
in his undisclosed
nobody
location.
Wants to see him. He's
Darth Cheney. Provided a copy, the Liz Cheney's office said that they would not comment on it. The vice president has respectfully but resolutely maintained the importance of protecting the ability of the president and vice president to receive candid advice on important national matters in confidence, a principle affirmed by the Supreme Court. Representative Henry Waxman, chairman of the House Oversight Government Reform Committee, who unsuccessfully pushed for details of the meeting, said it is ridiculous that it has taken 6 years to see who attended the meetings. He described the Energy Task Force as an early indicator of how selectively Vice President Cheney wanted to act. And in closing, Waxman said he is not surprised to see the prevalence of energy industry groups on the list of meetings. 6 years later, we lost an opportunity to become dependent on importing oil, on using fossil fuels, which have been a threat to our national security and well-being of the planet.
Yeah. And so, today the cost of oil went up to $100
yeah?
a barrel.
Oh, good.
Yes.
Grist reports other Cheney news. Spurred by an earlier piece in the Post, House Democrats plan to hold a hearing at the end of July, soon, next week, to look into the Veep's role in policy moves that led to massive die-off of the Klamath River salmon in 2002 that we spoke about in our last show.
Yeah.
Speaking of big oil, Garth Friends and ExxonMobil are being sued by New York State. Too bad.
Oh, yeah, really?
The shot has been fired in the quiet oil spill battle in Brooklyn, New York's Greenpoint neighborhood. The state has sued, this, by the way, from Grist, the state has sued ExxonMobil to force the cleanup of the estimated 8 million gallons of oil and petroleum byproducts still underground after a 1950 explosion. I remember that. I lived in New York. The spill, larger than the Exxon Valdez debacle, was found in 78. In 1990, the state asked ExxonMobil nicely to please take care of the 17 million remaining gallons. Since then, the company has reportedly cleaned up about 9.3 million. But New York wants the rest gone soon and is asking ExxonMobil, as well as BP, Chevron, utility Keyspan, and mining company Phelps Dodge, to treat contaminated soil and groundwater and restore nearby Newton Creek. The suit follows two others filed since 2004 by citizens and the advocacy group Riverkeeper. This suit sends the message that even the largest corporations in the world cannot escape the consequences of their misdeeds, says State Attorney General Andrew Cuomo. Andrew Cuomo.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, maybe only for 57 years or so. So.
Yeah, well, it's about time.
Speaking of water, do we have some... Just listen to some water. We'll shut up. Humans, shut up. Listen to the water. It's the Enviro Show Echo Chamber. Let's echo the words of former Green Party candidate for the Gov, Office of the Gov, Jill Stein, on the proposed, are you ready for this, creation of developer government. Stop the creation of developer governments. This is the bill in the Mass House, 40T, or H-159, or in the Senate, S-146. They aren't content with just manipulating government. Now they want to be the government. A bill known as Chapter... Oh, I see. That's the title of the bill. A bill known as Chapter 40T is moving swiftly through the legislature that would enable real estate developers to create their own special purpose governments within cities and towns. This allows crucial functions of local democratic government to be replaced by the rule of unelected developers with personal financial interests to advance. Can you believe this?
Yes, I can.
Developers, I can't believe it's so blatant. Developers and bond lawyers would be allowed to use government powers to enrich themselves by eliminating accountability, transparency, and public participation in crucial decision-making. Chapter 40T would strike at the heart of New England grassroots democracy. Specifically, 40T allows developers to be put in charge of special development districts, which would effectively constitute new developer-run municipalities. Within these districts, a governing committee, handpicked by the developers, would take on critical functions of elected municipal officials. Developers could raise taxes to pay for the infrastructure for their private projects without regard to Prop 2.5. They could pass their own bylaws, fine violators, and enjoy liability protection. It just goes on and on.
And it's now before the Senate and the House both?
Apparently. Call your state legislators immediately.
Who's pushing it?
They may vote on it before the end of the session on July 31st.
All right, I just have one comment.
What is that, Glenn?
But the truth is, there is something terribly wrong with this country, isn't there?
What's that? I didn't hear it.
So go to our blog, and there's a link for this, and or you can call Jill Steen and ask her personally, I guess. 617-821-1453. That's 617-821-1453. Google Enviro Show and go to our blog, and there's a link to it right there. You got to scream to your... Sam Rosenberg, he needs to hear from us about this.
Yeah.
And, of course, your rep. Too.
Just when you thought, you know, how could things get any worse?
Well,
they came up with their plan.
Like I thought I was reading something from a fiction, a novel.
But have you heard of Atlantica? Now, Atlantica is such the same kind of thing. It's a corporations from the maritime provinces of Canada and Maine and Vermont and New Hampshire getting together, and they're creating their own zone, their own little government that will help the development of that area. And this is already in the works. It's happening. It's called Atlantica.
Hmm.
We're dividing up. It goes along with the border thing, all the border security stuff, which is giving the governments of Canada and the United States the right to decide what you can do on the border. They can militarize the border if they want, or open it up, or join Montana with Winnipeg. Whatever they want to do, that's what they're doing.
It's like CAFTA on steroids or something.
Oh,
like
it's
that?
More than that, yeah. Because it takes two countries and pieces of the two countries and glues them together and lets the Chamber of Commerce of both those countries decide how they're going to develop the area.
All right. All right, we're still on the Enviro Show Echo Chamber, but this piece segues into tonight's topic about Nestle's so-called good life. This is from Alternate, Rural Communities Exploited by Nestle for Your Bottled Water. And we may get interrupted here by a call-in from either David or Tim Simmons. But let's go for it. Across the country, multinational corporations are targeting hundreds of rural communities to gain control of their most precious resources. By strong-arming small towns with limited economic means, these corporations are part of the growing trend to privatize public water supplies, or aquifers, in the case of Monaco, for economic gain in the ballooning bottled water industry, with sales of over $35 billion worldwide in the bottled water market. Corporations are doing whatever it takes to buy up pristine springs in some of our country's most beautiful places. While the companies reap profits, the local communities and the environment are paying the price. One of the biggest and most voracious of the water gobblers is Nestle, which controls one-third of the U.S. market and sells 70 different brand names, such as Arrowhead, Calistoga, Deer Park, Perrier, Poland Spring, and Ice Mountain, which draws from 75 springs located all over the country. Nestle's latest target is McLeod, located in the shadow of Northern California's snow-capped Mount Shasta. I would say that Nestle's latest target is the Montague Plains, right here in Franklin County, in our listening area. Anyway, the town of McLeod has less than 1,400 people and a high school of 4 students. But one thing McLeod does have is an abundance of water, pristine spring water that comes from Shasta's glaciers and feeds some of the world's best fly fishing rivers. The water hasn't just brought outdoors people to the area. It's also brought a new industry that seems strikingly similar to the timber barons who came before, taking resources, reaping profits, and moving on. 4 years ago, residents learned that Nestle, the world's largest food and beverage company, intended to build a 1 million square foot water bottling facility in McLeod. Without any public input or environmental impact assessment, the multinational was given a 100-year contract to pump 1,600 acre feet of spring water a year and a seemingly unlimited amount of groundwater. Moving on, it says, under the terms of the contract, Nestle will make out handsomely. The McLeod Watershed Council has reported that Nestle will pay, are you ready? $0.00087
for what?
For a gallon of the water that it takes from McLeod Springs. On the other hand, Nestle can sell a 16-ounce bottle of the same water for around $1.29 or $10.32 per gallon. For the townspeople of McLeod, the contract is not so fruitful. That's an understatement. The contract
there's gold in them, Dar Hills.
I guess. The contract makes no provision for inflation or change in water flow or value over the course of a 100-year agreement. And Nestle maintains the rights to the water, but the legal responsibility for the spring remains with the town. Quote, this would leave the people of McLeod holding the legal bag for any environment violations resulting from Nestle's operations and any resulting lawsuits, said the Watershed Council's website. Nestle seems to have its infiltration of rural towns down to a science. The best places are the ones where they can play the jobs card.
Oh, like in Montague.
And the subject of jobs has already come up on the Montague website.
Yeah, it has.
In Mecosta County, Michigan, where Nestle opened a spring water bottling plant a few years ago, locals have yet to see the promised economic rewards. We found that they mostly hire temp workers, said Donald Roy, who is involved with the Citizens Action Group. They pay many of them $10 an hour, no benefits for a temp position, and then they can lay them off and not have to worry about compensation. Costa County's battle with Nestle was recently detailed in the book Thirst, Fighting the Corporate.
Yes, that's a very good book.
For our water, yeah. And we had to, I think the author came here.
Yeah, we had to have him here.
In South Hadley at the bookstore. The area is among several that have waged battles against the beveraging giant, along with communities in Maine, Florida, Texas. And moving on, environmental implications. The McLeod River is one of the most beloved rivers in the state of California, explains Brian Stranko of the group California Trout, which works to protect the state's wild fish. Stranko and his group worry that Nestle's project in McLeod will adversely affect the watershed and its aquatic species. The aquifer is volcanic porous. Aqua-colored glacial melt comes from Mount Shasta and mixes with the ancient groundwater from under the mountain as it bubbles up to the river. The McLeod River, which from which Nestle will be drawing, runs into the Shasta Reservoir 40 miles to the south. The reservoir is one of the biggest in the state and is a huge component of California's water supply. From there, the water collects in several rivers and flows to the Sacramento, feeding cities, towns, and farms in the Sacramento Valley. And I think this is in closing to try to quell fears about the water bottling plant's potential effects on the watershed. A draft environmental impact statement was released last summer. Oh, no, a little more here. The EIR was one of the worst, if not the worst, that we've ever seen, said Stanko. We were shocked by how poor it was. It didn't address some of the environmental concerns, and it was not thorough and didn't explain alternatives. Attorney Marsha Birch, who represents Concern McLeod Citizens, wrote, in almost every technical area, the draft EIR contains insufficient data and analysis, thus failing to provide adequate information to public decision makers. The enormous impacts are downplayed, the analysis is weak, and mitigation measures weaker. The entire document reads like a post-decisional justification for the project. The plant will also affect not just McLeod River, but the entire watershed, reducing the stream flow to the McLeod Falls River, Squaw Creek, Soda Springs, Big Spurs, Murr. Oh, and it just names a whole bunch of rivers. An estimated 77% of Northern California's water comes from that area, so the impact on communities downstream, many of them agricultural, will be dire.
Well, if somebody tried to look at the Montague thing from the point of just taking this as sort of a model of what was likely to happen and take a look at it and see what is happening, what could happen.
I'm sure to begin with they won't want to do any kind of study like that. They'll want to let Nestle make their case for exploiting the resource, and then, you know, the state will have to do some kind of cursory evaluation of it, but they won't want to do anything in depth, any detailed analysis.
But maybe we could do something. Some of us go out there and take a look at it, see what's happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, the other thing about this is the cost. Like in the thing in New York, they said that it will cost 49 cents a year if you get your water from the New York City. The New York City water is very good. It has a very high quality.
Right.
49 cents a year. But if you buy it in bottles, it'll cost you $1,400 a year, you know?
Yeah.
And then if you look at all the studies that have been done, it shows that people can't tell the difference between bottled water and tap water. And most of the time they choose, when they're given Dasani and tap, they think the tap is better. And most of the time that's the direction it goes. So why are people buying water in bottles? Water is not a commodity. It's ours. It belongs to us. Why do we let somebody like Nestle put it in a bottle and sell it back to us?
Well, I think it's become a status symbol for a lot of people.
I want to say one other thing, though. Nestle's water's vice president has said, we sell water, so we have to be clever. We have to be clever because we sell water.
All right. Let me just close this piece out. It says, keeping water as a public trust is paramount to maintaining ecologically healthy communities and safe, affordable drinking water for everyone. Powerful political power of Nestle is quite significant. They have been able to negotiate behind closed doors, and we want to expose this. Nestle is literally locking up a spring that has been part of the public commons and a place for people to visit and appreciate.
Yeah.
So who do we have on the line here? Is this Tim Simmons?
It was Tim, but I hung up on him.
No.
Not intentionally.
Oh, no. We lost Tim.
Tim, call back, please.
Oh, how did that happen?
Well, efficiency is...
Operator error.
Yeah. Operator error.
This is an example of why we shouldn't have nuclear reactors.
But the other thing that has happened with Nestle had in the Detroit area, right close to the lake, Lake Michigan, they had a plant there, and they said they weren't taking water from the lake, but they were drilling and taking water from the aquifers around the lake, and they were taking like 400 gallons a minute out of the damn lake, and so people were saying, well, it doesn't matter that they're not pumping directly from the lake, they are pumping indirectly from the lake,
yeah.
And they took it to court.
Someone on the Montague website had some concern about the Montague public well, which apparently is above the aquifer, and would pumping from the aquifer affect the town well?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, it's all connected. Surface water, groundwater, they're all connected.
Yeah. So the closing part of this says, across the country, organizations, this is from the alternate piece, across the country, organizations like Corporate Accountability International are launching initiatives to help people think outside the bottle and realize the environmental and social implications of drinking bottled water. They're also urging communities to enact legislation to protect their water resources from corporate abuse,
yes,
and for people to help support rural communities that are challenging multinationals with unlimited financial resources. The stakes are high. Companies like Nestle are threatening local and democratic control of water, but people are starting to realize that we are beginning to see a more informed and concerned public. Over and over we hear communities saying our water is not for sale. Okay, we have Tim Simmons, a restoration ecologist from Mass Wildlife, on the line. And
Tim, hi Tim, are you there?
I'm there.
Hiya Tim, thanks for calling in. You're out on the vineyard now, right?
That's correct.
Right. Well, tell us about the Montague Plains and what your studies have found and what the ecological value is there and if it's threatened, if you would.
Well, the Montague Plains is developed on a vast glacial delta system, 10,000 years old. It's all sand, and there's a lot of water in that sand, no question about it. And these types of substrates help what we call barrens to develop. And pitch pine scrub oak barrens are home to an enormous number of rare and endangered species and species that are in decline region-wide. And the last remaining large barrens in New England is the one at Montague Plains that we've protected after 30 years of negotiations and purchases from a couple of different entities. There are about 25 different species out there that are of conservation concern that we are managing for. And we have a research-based management program out there that's been going on for about 10 years with, working with Harvard and UMass on just trying to understand how this place works and what do we need to do to maintain all those plants and animals into the future.
Tim, what, can you name some of the species that, that are threatened that live there out on the plain?
I can. Yeah, there's a suite of moths and butterflies that are dependent on the plants that occur out there. Barron's buck moth is one. There's a number of obscure names like that, but frosted elfin butterfly is another that feeds on lupin. It's done okay on the plains. And then there's a whole bunch of birds, brown thrasher, prairie warbler, eastern tully, that are thriving on the plains, due in part to the vegetation that was there when we got there and when we bought it, but also what has happened since we began to manage it. So there's a, and there's a number of reptiles that are regionally declining, box turtles and hognose snakes and things that are doing well on the plains. It's a magnificent place, so once you get to know it.
Well, I can tell that it has a special place in your heart. I promised that I wasn't going to put you on the spot there, but can you tell us something about the aquifer? Are you familiar with the...
It's curious. It, you know, it hasn't been thoroughly studied, but in the days when they had planned for a two-tower nuclear power management plant out there,
all right,
they wanted to believe that there was not a a very substantive aquifer there. However, as soon as they started doing the test holes, we found out that, of course, there's a ton of water moving there. We knew that already because the first tract we purchased out there, we purchased to protect the water supply for our trout hatchery. We knew that it percolated down through those sands and came out across the road where our hatchery exists. So we don't know how much water is there, and we don't know what the water quality is, but we know that there's plenty of water there. And that's typical of any one of these barren situations. No matter where you are in New England, they are sandy places through which water percolates and accumulates quickly. So there's a ton of water there.
Were you part of the studies that Glenn Motzkin was involved in?
To a certain degree, the Harvard studies out there were very beneficial to us, and they had been conducting them for a few years before we arrived on the scene. So I asked them to assemble and accumulate all those so they could inform our management goals and activities out there. So I worked pretty closely with Glenn and other researchers in the area.
They were looking at a lot of the unique ecological characteristics on the plains.
Well, what they were looking at was to try to understand, A, what this means to have 1,500 acres of intact pine barrens left in the center-western portion of the state, and what was the land use history of that place that that led to it continuing to sustain all these plants and animals that we care about. So they did a very methodical, systematic research project where they looked at individual tracts of land and they looked at their soil characteristics to determine how and when they were last used in agriculture, if at all, and what the vegetation and the habitat, if you will, looks like now. And that was very informative to us, because it turns out that about 85% of the plains had been used for some kind of agriculture. Mm-hmm. But we had these, if you will, refugia, the areas where it had not been, the soil completely turned over, and those are being used to repopulate the other areas. So it's a pure restoration project where we're trying to restore some aspect of the vegetation as we can reconstruct it. They did a lot of historical work, too, as we can reconstruct it from historical accounts, assuming that that's going to benefit all the plants and animals that we care about out there.
Yeah. Is there an overall management plan for the Montague Plains?
For the portion that is owned by the Division of Fisheries and Wildlife, there's a management plan and a fuels and fire management plan, because the distinctive feature of these barrens is that they have a propensity to burn frequently. So we had 112 fires out there in 75 years. So we had two goals here. One was to protect public health and safety and firefighter safety, but also to restore the ecological conditions that fire brings to the system. So we're doing a research-based habitat management program that accommodates the use of prescribed fire under very carefully defined conditions.
Uh-huh. And would this kind of proposed use of the Montague Plain be compatible with the kind of restoration? Was this envisioned by the management plan?
I have not seen what they're proposing, so I really don't know. Yeah. But I can tell you that would have to be evaluated very, very carefully. And as I said in another comment, we know now what we didn't know 50 years ago, but in many of these very porous situations, the rivers, ponds, and streams are very, very closely connected to the groundwater flowing through those gravels and sands. Mm-hmm. And we know that you can reduce the water budget for a river, pond, and stream by extracting water, and that would be one of our number one concerns, not just for the wetlands and on the property we own, but also for the adjacent wetlands, and that would have to be carefully considered.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. So where can people find out more information about the Montague Plains, the ecology and the history of it? Is there a good... we get in trouble for always mentioning websites, but is there a good place to go on online to find out information about the ecology there?
There is a website that I can't tell you from memory right now, but if you look for Northeastern Pine Barrens, there's a site that links all the barrens in the Northeast, because one of the facets of the research-based management we've been doing at Montague has been informing the management of similar systems in New Hampshire and New York and Long Island and various other places where they have a similar situation. So we decided that our best bang for our buck was to pull all our information. So if you search on Northeast Barrens, you'll find it.
Okay. Yes. Tim, thanks so much for calling in and giving us this.
Huh? Yeah, I just wanted to say that there's a New Hampshire town that that confronted some of the same problem, and they ban corporate water withdrawals from their town. And it might be interesting to look at and see what their findings were and what they did. And the town is Barnstead.
Barnstead,
New Hampshire.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, wildlife management areas are protected by Article 97 of the Constitution,
mm-hmm.
so commercial uses would be looked at with a great deal of rigor.
Good.
Thanks a lot, Tim.
Thank you.
Have a good time out there, Tim. Take care.
Go on.
All right. Now that sounds like a good job. I would love to have a job like that.
Yeah, not bad.
Oh, yeah. Tim Simmons, restoration ecologist with Mass Wildlife. So this whole deal, Nestle is proposing to build this water extraction and bottling facility in Montague to take the aquifer water from the under this conservation land at 150 million gallons per year. So here are some of the concerns that are being bandied about here. Loss of groundwater and environmental impacts, toxicity of plastics manufacturing and waste, large volume of truck traffic to cart water to New England and the broader region. The company wants to, by the way, fill a gap between Maine and Pennsylvania with this plant operation. Privatization of water, of course, of public water, and massive change in local politics and economic impacts of several hundred new people moving into an otherwise into or otherwise needing taxpayer services, roads, schools, etc. in Montague because of the plant. And this comes from an email that was sent out by Tina Clark, who's been on this show. Tina's, of course, concerned about this. She's with
Clean Water Action?
That's right. So we need some clean water action in, on the Montague Plains. So it goes on to say the Nestle proposal. The Nestle Corporation is in the process of asking permission from Mass Fisheries and Wildlife to conduct investigations on land, of course, owned by Fish and Wildlife, specifically, I thought it was owned by us, specifically the Montague Plains Wildlife Management Area that Tim was just talking about, to determine its potential for a spring water pumping and bottling facility. If the investigation is allowed, and there's going to be a meeting coming up, and I'll give you info on that in a moment, and the water source deemed able to support a minimum threshold of pumping 150 million gallons per year, Nestle's might then propose construction of a $150 million spring water bottling plant as being touted as clean industry, bringing 350 to 400 jobs, and we just heard about the jobs earlier, part-time dead-end jobs, to town and tax revenue, etc. Its impacts on ground and surface water, habitat, etc. have not been evaluated. Should it proceed, it would most likely trigger a full income, rather a full impact statement under the MEPA. So what are the questions about this?
Well, one of the things that I just found out today that I hadn't known before is I always think about the bottles as being a problem after, you know, they're used and
the
bottles are thrown away. But it turns out that that's not quite the thing. More than 90% of the environmental impact from a plastic bottle happened before the consumer opens it, said Dr. Alan Hershkowitz, a senior scientist at the National Resource Defense Council. Oil for plastic, oil for shipping, oil for refrigeration, and in the end, most of the effort goes to the landfills. The bottle is going to have to change, he said.
Yeah, a lot of plastic, plastic bottles especially end up in water and in the ocean,
where
now the oceans are, you know, rapidly becoming a plastic soup in the mid-Pacific areas.
And most of the water that's in the bottles, at least a quarter of that that they've tested, is really tap water. It's nothing other than tap water.
Yeah.
Let me give the info on the public meeting before we run out of time here. So this is the meeting of the Fisheries and Wildlife Board, and I'm assuming Nestle or their representative will be there as well. And, of course, it's a public meeting. I'm not sure of the setup in terms of how you'll be able to speak, but I know I have already heard of people planning on going and raising hell for all intents and purposes. This is Tuesday, July 31st at 1 p.m., meeting of the Fisheries and Wildlife Board. Nestle is talking with Mass Wildlife to obtain permission to enter the Montague Plains Wildlife Management Area and perform a site investigation. This investigation would culminate in long-term pumping test well to stress the aquifer and see how it reacts in order to determine its long-term sustainable yield. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Regional Office is where this will take place. That's 300 Westgate Drive off Route 116 and Route 9 in Hadley. It's right there at the light.
It's behind Staples.
Yeah, right, behind Staples, right on Route 9.
It's easy to get to. I hope there's lots of people there.
I hope so, too. I know that Charles up at Trap Rock said he's going to be there, and hopefully a lot of folks from Montague will turn out as well. I know that David Detmold at the Montague Reporter is following this story, and it's, as I said, it's being talked about on the Montague website. So, again, that's Tuesday, July 31st at 1 p.m., so protest. Be there.
Now, you may remember that the people of Cochabamba in Bolivia fought the Bechtel Corporation, which was taking water away from them, and they won. And this was a few years ago, but they made a declaration. Should I read their declaration?
Yeah, sure.
One, water belongs to the earth and all species and is sacred to life. Therefore, the earth's water must be conserved, reclaimed, and protected for future generations and its natural patterns respected. Two, water is a fundamental human right and a public trust to be guarded by all levels of government. Therefore, it should not be commodified, privatized, or traded for commercial purposes. These rights must be enshrined at all levels of government. In particular, an international treaty must ensure these principles are non-controvertible. And three, water is best protected by local communities and citizens who must be respected as equal partners with governments in the protection and regulation of water. Peoples of the earth are the only vehicle to promote earth democracy and save water. The idea that the people should be equal partners with government, I find really problematic, because the government is supposed to be for the people, but of course it rarely is.
Yes.
And especially in cases like this, when the big corporations have large amounts of money that can pay off politicians.
Yeah, then we really see what a fascist state we're living in. Really, it's run by corporations.
Yes. And when it sells our water becomes a commodity.
Yeah.
Food becomes a commodity, and building these things that make energy, these energy windmills around, giving that air to private corporations. That's our air. This is our water. It ought not to be privatized. It ought not to be commodified.
That's right. I think the idea is to resist corporate takeover of public resources whenever they're proposed. So
we need
to have a pledge of resistance,
right,
against this project. Let Nestle know that it's over my dead body.
It's no longer out there, listeners. The privatization of the commons is happening right here in the valley on the Montague Plains. It's time to get up and act.
And unfortunately, much of what has already happened is not reversible. This one is reversible, so let's do it now.
Yep.
All right. I hope Sam Lovejoy is out there listening. We're going to move on to Bus Stop Billboard, a sort of truncated version. On Thursday, July 26th, from 3 to 8 p.m., Mass Central Rail Trail Coalition events are happening, a walking tour of downtown, a biking tour of the path network being developed, dinner meeting at the Northampton Brewery. For information, call 413-575-2277. Don't forget, on our blog, we have all these things listed, plus links about everything we talked about. Just Google in Enviro Show. You'll get there. And, of course, as we mentioned, Tuesday, July 31st, 1 p.m., meeting of the Fisheries and Wildlife Board over the Nestle assault or planned assault on the Montague Plains. That's at U.S. Fish and Wildlife Office right there on the corner of Route 116 and Route 9 in Hadley. And on Saturday, August 4 at 11 a.m. in the Greenfield Town Common, a vigil and speak out to mark the beginning of Hiroshima Nagasaki Remembrance Week, a time to honor those who died and suffered due to the U.S. atomic bombing of those Japanese cities. For info, contact Hattie at 978-249-6224 or Debbie Katz, who's, of course, been on our show from Citizens Awareness Network. Deb can be reached at 413-339-5781. And then, of course, 33rd Annual Northeast Organic Farming Association Summer Conference in celebration of sustainable living. You maybe heard the PSA before the show. That's Friday, August 10th to Sunday, August 12th at Hampshire College in Amherst. For info on that, go to www.nofamass.org or call 978-355-2853. Okay, that's almost it for us. We're going to go out with New World Water by Mos Def from his Black on Both Sides album. Once again, don't forget to check out the blog for all the links, things we talked about. Too bad we didn't hear from David Kruzma biking across the U.S. with his partner for the Ride for Climate, but there's a couple links to it there. He had a YouTube video, which was pretty entertaining. You can check that out on our blog.
All right.
Just Google in Enviro Show. We'll be back in 2 weeks for the big fundraising grand finale plus our birthday party.
Yeah. So
we got a birthday party coming up. And next up is the Hilltown Family Variety Show. Okay. Good night.
And we'll see
Thanks
you in 2 weeks.
Thanks for stopping in. This is Dio saying bye.
Good night.
Good night.
And here we go.
Nothing more refreshing than a quickly, crisp, clean glass of water on a warm summer's day.
That cool, refreshing drink.
Try it, dear friend.
New World Water makes the tide rise high. Come inland and make your house go by. Fools done upset the old man river. Made him carry slave ships and fed them dead niggas. Now it's really full of me about the flood something. So I'm throwing rope that ain't tied to nothing. Tell your crew use the H2 and Y's amounts. This the New World Water and every drop counts. You can laugh and take it as a joke if you wanna. But it don't rain a full week some summers. And it's about to get real wild in the half. You be buying every yard just to take a poking bath. Heads is acting wild, sipping boom, pumping dank. Competing with the next man for higher playing rank. Right. Since I ain't got time, try to be Big Hank. Hulk the bank. I need a 20-year water tank. Cause while these knuckleheads is out here sweating and good. Sun is sitting in the treetop, burning the woods. And it's a flame from the blaze get higher and higher. They say, don't drink the water, we need it for the fire. New York is drinking it. New World. And all of California is drinking it. New World. Boy, you're going down south is drinking it. New World. To have minerals is zinking it. New World. Now they say it got lead is thinking it. Fluorocarbons and monoxide. Push the water table lopside. Used to be free, now of course you will feed. Cause all tanks really loaded, they roll across the sea. Man, you gotta cook with it, baby, clean with
that's
it.
Right.
When it's hot summertime, you feed for
that's
it.
No.
You gotta put it in the iron, you steaming with
it. Right.
That's what they dress wounds and treat diseases
with.
The rich and poor, black and white got need for
that's
it.
Right.
And everybody in the world can agree with
that's
this.
No.
Consumption promotes health and easiness.
That's
go
right.
too long without it on this earth and you leaving
Shout it out.
Americans wasting it on some leisure shit. Another nation be desperately seeking
that's
it.
Enough.
Bacteria washing up on they beaches.
Say
don't drink the water so they can't wash their feet with
that's
it.
Enough.
Young babies in perpetual need these
Say
days.
Word.
Epidemics hopping up the petri dish. Control centers trying to play all secret
that's
it.
Word.
To avoid public panic and freaking.
That's
there are
enough.
Places where TV is common as TV. Cause foreign-based companies go and get greedy. The type of cats who pollute the whole shoreline. Have it purified and sell it for $1.25. Now the world is drinking that.
New
Your mom's wife and baby girl is drinking that. New
world.
Up and down south is drinking that. The fish looking cockeyed, used to be free, now of course you a fee, cause it's all about getting that cash money, said 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 it's all about getting that cash money, Johnny Cash money, give me cat money, cold cat money, Johnny Cat money, Rose and Cat money, give me cat money, cat money, cat money, casual everything around me, move, move.